At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Chapter 9 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Reading by Greg Marguerite. This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 9. Eric Donovan, 2031. Eric was glad to get to the office and shut the door. Lately he'd had this feeling whenever he went out, this feeling that people were staring at him. It wasn't just his imagination. They did stare. Every younger person over a yard high got stared at nowadays as if they were freaks. And it wasn't just the staring that got him down either. Sometimes they muttered and mumbled, and sometimes they called names. Eric didn't mind stuff like dirty naturalist. That he could understand. Once upon a time, way back, everybody who was against the left law was called a naturalist. And before that it had still another meaning, or so he'd been told. Today, of course, it just meant anyone who was over 5 feet tall. No, he could take the ordinary name-calling all right, but sometimes they said other things. They used words nobody ever uses unless they really hate you and want to kill you. And that was at the bottom of it, Eric knew. They did hate him. They did want to kill him. Was he a coward? Perhaps. But it wasn't just Eric's imagination. You never saw anything about such things on the telescreens, but naturalists were being killed every day. The older people were still in the majority, but the youngsters were coming up fast, and there were so many more of them. Besides, they were more active, and this created the illusion that there were yardsticks everywhere. Eric sat down behind his desk, grinning. Yardsticks. When he was a kid, it had been just the other way around. He and the rest of them who didn't get shots in those early days considered themselves to be the normal ones, and they did the name-calling. Names like Runt, and Half-Pint, and Midgey. But the most common name was the one that stuck, Yardstick. That used to be the worst insult of all. But now it wasn't an insult anymore. Being taller was the insult. Being a dirty naturalist or a son of a naturalist. Times certainly had changed. Eric glanced at the communicator. Almost noon and it had not flicked yet. There he'd been, beaming these big offers. You'd think he'd get some response to an expensive beaming program, but no. Maybe that was the trouble. Nobody liked big things anymore. Everything was small. He shifted uneasily in his chair. That was one consolation, at least. He still had old-time furniture, getting to be harder and harder to find stuff that fitted him these days. Seemed like most of the firms making furniture and bedding and household appliances were turning out the small stuff for the younger generation. Cheaper to make, less material, and more demand for it. Government allocated size priorities to the manufacturers. It was even murder to ride public transportation because of the space reductions. Eric drove his own jetter. Besides, that way was safer. Crowded into a liner with a gang of yardsticks with only a few other naturalists around, there might be trouble. Oh, it was getting to be a yardstick world, and no mistake. Smaller furniture, smaller meals, smaller sizes in clothing, smaller buildings. That reminded Eric of something, and he frowned again. Damn it, why didn't the communicator flick? He should be getting some kind of inquiries. Hell, he was practically giving the space away. But there was only silence, as there had been all during this past week. That's why he let Lorette go. Sweet girl, but there was no work for her here anymore. No work and no pay, either. Besides, the place spooked her. She'd been the one who suggested leaving, really. Eric, I'm sorry, but I just can't take this anymore. All alone in this huge building, it's curling my toes. At first he tried to talk her out of it. Don't be silly, Luscious. There's Bernstein down on 10, and Saltonstall above us, and Wallaby and Son on 14. I tell you this place is coming back to life. I can feel it. I'll beam for tenants next week. You'll see. Actually, he'd been talking against his own fear, and Lorette must have known it. Anyway, she left, and now he was here, alone. Alone. Eric didn't like the sound of that word, or the absence of sound behind it. Three other tenants in a 90-story building. Three other tenants in a place that had once held 3,000. Why, 50 years ago, when this place went up, you couldn't buy a vacancy. Where had the crowds gone to? He knew the answer, of course. The left shots had created the new generation of yardsticks, and they lived in their own world, their shrunken, dehydrated world of dollhouses and miniatures. They deserted the old-fashioned skyscrapers and cut the big apartment buildings up into tiny cubicles. Two could occupy the space formerly reserved for one. That had been the purpose of the left shots in the first place, to put an end to overcrowding and conserve on resources. Well, it had worked out. Worked out too perfectly for people like Eric Donovan. Eric Donovan, rental agent for a building nobody wanted anymore. A 90-story mausoleum, and nobody could collect rent from ghosts. Ghosts. Eric damn near jumped through the ceiling when the door opened and this man walked in. He was tall and tow-headed. Eric stared. There was something vaguely familiar about his face. Something about those ears. That was it, those ears. No, it couldn't be. It wasn't possible. Eric stood up and held out his hand. "I'm Donovan," he said. The tow-headed man smiled and nodded. "Yes, I know. Don't you remember me?" "I thought I knew you from someplace. You wouldn't be Sam Walzik." The tow-headed man's smile became a broad grin. "That's not what you were going to say, Eric. You were going to say, Handlehead, weren't you? Well, go on, say it. I don't mind. I've been called a lot worse things since we were kids together." "I can't believe it," Eric murmured. "It's really you, old Handlehead Walzik. And after all these years turning up to rent an office from me, well, what do you know?" "I didn't come here to rent an office." "Oh? Then it was your name that brought me. I recognized it on the beamings. This is a social call, eh? Well, that's good. I don't get much company these days. Sit down and have a reef." Walzak sat down, but refused the smoke. "I know quite a bit about your setup," he said. "You and your three tenants. It's tough, Eric." "Oh, things could be worse." Eric forced a laugh. "It isn't as if my bucks depended on the number of tenants in the building. Government subsidizes this place. I'm sure of a job as long as I live." "As long as you live." Walzak stared at him in a way he didn't like. "And just how long do you figure that to be?" "I'm only 26, Eric answered. "According to statistics, that gives me maybe another 60 years. "Statistics." Walzak said it like a dirty word. "Your life expectancy isn't determined by statistics anymore. I say you don't have 60 months left, perhaps not even 60 days. What are you trying to hand me?" "The truth, and don't go looking for a silver platter underneath it either." "But I mind my own business. I don't hurt anybody. Why should I be in any danger?" "Why does a government subsidy support one rental manager to sit here in this building every day, but 10 guards to patrol it every night?" Eric opened his mouth wide before shaping it for speech. "Who told you that?" "Like I said, I know the setup." Walzak crossed his legs, but he didn't lean back. "And in case you haven't guessed it, this is a business call, not a social one." Eric sighed. "Might have figured," he said. "You're a naturalist, aren't you?" "Of course I am. We all are." "Not I." "Oh, yes. Whether you like it or not, you're a naturalist, too. As far as the yardsticks are concerned, everyone over 3 feet high is a naturalist, an enemy, someone to be hated and destroyed." "Think I'd believe that?" "Sure. I know they don't like us. And why should they? We eat twice as much, we take up twice the space, and I guess when we were kids we gave a lot of them a hard time. Besides, outside of a few exceptions like ourselves, all the younger generation are yardsticks, with more coming every year. The older people hold the key positions and the power. Of course, there's a lot of friction and resentment, but you know all that." "Certainly," Walzak nodded. "All that and more, much more. I know that up until a few years ago, no yardstick held any public office or government position. Now they're starting to move in, particularly in Europe, Asia. But there's so many of them now, adults in their early 20s, that the pressure is building up. They're impatient, getting out of hand. They won't wait until the old folks die off. They want control now. And if they ever manage to get it, we're finished for good." "Impossible," Eric said. "Impossible?" Wolzik's voice was a mocking echo. "You sit there in this tomb, and when somebody tells you that the world you know has died, you refuse to believe it. Even though every night after you sneak home and huddle up inside your room trying not to be noticed, 10 guards patrol this place with subatomics so the yardstick gangs won't break in and take over. So they won't do what they did down south, overrun the office buildings and the factories and break them up, cut them down to size for living quarters." "But they were stopped," Eric objected. "I saw it on the telescreen. The security forces stopped them." "Crapola." Walzak pronounced the archaicism with studied care. "You saw films, faked films. Have you ever traveled, Eric? Been down south and seen conditions there? Nobody travels nowadays, you know that. Priorities.
I travel, Eric, and I know. Security forces don't suppress anything in the south these days, because they're made up of yardsticks now.
That's right, yardsticks exclusively. And in a few years, that's the way it will be up here. Did you ever hear about the Chicago riots?
You mean last year when the yardsticks tried to take over the synthetic plants at the stockyards?
Tried? They succeeded. The workers ousted management. Over 50,000 were killed in the revolution.
Oh, don't look so shocked. That's the right word for it. But the yardsticks won out in the end.
But the telescreens showed...
Damn the telescreens. I know, because I happened to be there when it happened. And if you had been there, you and a few million other ostriches who sit with your heads buried in telescreens, maybe we could have stopped them.
I don't believe it. I can't.
All right. Think back. That was last year. And since the first of this year, what's happened to the standard size meat ration?
They cut it in half, Eric admitted, but that's because of ag shortages, according to the telescreen reports.
He stood up, gulping.
Look here, I'm not going to listen to any more of this kind of talk. By rights, I ought to turn your name in.
Go ahead, Walczak waved his hand. It's happened before. I was reported when I blasted the yardsticks who shot my father down when he tried to land his jet in a southern field. I was reported when they killed Annette.
Annette?
You remember that name, don't you, Eric? Your first girl, wasn't she?
Well, I'm the guy who married her.
Yes, and I'm the guy who talked her into having a baby without the benefit of left shots.
Sure, it's illegal, and only a few of us ever try it anymore, but we both agreed that we wanted it that way. A real life-sized normal baby. Or abnormal, according to the yardsticks and the stupid government.
It was a dirty scum of a government doctor who let her die on the table when he discovered the child weighed 7 pounds.
That's when I really woke up, Eric. That's when I knew there was going to be only one decision to make in the future. Kill or be killed.
Annette, she died, you say?
Walczak moved over and put his hand on Eric's shoulder.
You never married her, did you, Eric?
I think I know why. It's because you felt the way I did about it. You wanted a regular kid, not a yardstick. Only you didn't quite have the guts to try and beat the law.
Well, you'll need guts now, because it's getting to the point where the law can't protect you anymore. The government is made up of old men, and they're afraid to take action. In a few years, they'll be pushed out of office all over the world. We'll have yardstick government then, all the way, and yardstick law. And that means they'll cut us down to size.
But what can we do about it?
Plenty. There's still a little time if we naturalists can only get together. Stop being just a name and become an organized force. Maybe the ending will be different. We've got to try, in any case.
The yardsticks are human beings just like us, Eric said slowly. We can't just declare war on them, wipe them out. It's not their fault. They were born that way.
Walczak nodded. I know. Nothing is anybody's fault, really. This whole business began in good faith. Leffingwell and some of the other geniuses saw a problem and offered what they sincerely believed was a solution.
But it didn't work, Eric murmured.
Wrong. It worked only too well. That's the trouble.
Sure, we eliminated our difficulties on the physical level. In less than 30 years, we've reached a point where there's no longer any danger of overcrowding or starvation. But the psychological factor is something we can't cope with. We thought we'd ended war and the possibilities of war a long time ago. But it isn't foreign enemies we must fear today. We've created a nation divided into Davids and Goliaths. And David and Goliath are always enemies.
David killed Goliath, Eric said. Does that mean we're going to die?
Only if we're as stupid as Goliath was. Only if we wear our telescreens like invisible armor and pay no attention to the slingshots in David's hands.
Eric lit a reef.
All right, he said. You don't have to lecture. I'm willing to join. But I'm no Goliath. Really, I never had a fight in my life. What could I do to help?
You're a rental agent. You have the keys to this building. The guards don't bother you by day, do they? You come and go as you please. That means you can get into the cellars. You can help us move the stuff down there. And we'll take care of the guards some night after that.
I don't understand.
The friendly pressure on Eric's shoulder became a fierce grip.
You don't have to understand. All you do is let us plant the stuff in the cellars and let us get rid of the guards afterwards in our own way. The yardsticks will do the rest.
You mean take over the building when it's not protected?
Of course.
They'll take it over completely, once they see there's no opposition, and they'll remodel it to suit themselves, and within a month there'll be 10,000 yardsticks sitting in this place. The government will never stand still for that. Wake up. It's happening all over, all the time, and nothing is being done to prevent it. Security is too weak, and officials are too timid to risk open warfare, so the yardsticks win, and I'm going to see that they win this place.
But how will that help us?
You don't see it yet, do you? And neither will the yardsticks, until some fine day 3 or 4 months from now when we get around to what will be planted in the cellars. Somebody will throw a switch miles away and... boom.
Walzak, you couldn't!
It's coming. Not only here, but in 50 other places. We've got to fight fire with fire, Eric. It's our only chance. Bring this thing out into the open. Make the government realize this is war. Civil war. That's the only way to force them to take real action. We can't do it any other way. It's illegal to organize politically, and petitions do no good. We can't get a hearing.
Well, they'll have to listen to the explosions.
I just don't know.
Maybe you're the one who should have married Annette after all. Walzak's voice was cold. Maybe you could have watched her scream and beg and die, and never wanted to move a muscle to do anything about it afterwards. Maybe you're the model citizen, Eric, you and the thousands of others who are standing by and letting the yardsticks chop us down one by one. They say in nature it's survival of the fittest. Well, perhaps you're not fit to survive.
Eric wasn't listening.
She screamed, he said. You heard her scream?
Walzak nodded. I can still hear her. I'll always hear her.
Eric blinked abruptly. When do we start?
Walzak smiled at him. It was a pretty good smile for a man who can always hear screaming.
I knew I could count on you, he murmured. Nothing like old friends.
Funny, isn't it? Eric tried to match his smile. The way things work out. You and I being kids together, you marrying my girl, and then us meeting up again this way.
Yes, said Walzak, and he wasn't smiling now.
I guess it's a small world.
End of Chapter 9 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 10 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Reading by Greg Marguerite. This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 10. Harry Collins, 2032. Harry's son's house was on the outskirts of Washington, near what had once been called Gettysburg. Harry was surprised to find that it was a house, and a rather large one, despite the fact that almost all the furniture had been scaled down proportionately to fit the needs of a man 3 feet high. But then Harry was growing accustomed to surprises. He found a room of his own, ready and waiting on the second floor. Here the furniture was of almost antique vintage, but adequate in size, and here, in an atmosphere of unaccustomed comfort, he could talk. "So you're a physician, eh?" Harry gazed down into the diminutive face, striving to accept the fact that he was speaking to a mature adult, his own son, his and Sue's. A grown man and a doctor. It seemed incredible. But then, nothing was more incredible than the knowledge that he was actually here in his child's home. "We're all specialists in one field or another," his son explained. "Every one of us born and surviving during the early experimental period received our schooling under a plan Leffingwell set up. It was part of his conditional agreement that we become wards of the state. He knew the time might come when we'd be needed." "But why wasn't all this done openly?" "You know the answer to that. There was no way of educating us under the prevailing system. And there was always a danger we might be singled out as freaks who must be destroyed, particularly in those early years. So Leffingwell relied on secrecy, just as he did during his experimentation period. You know how you felt about that. You believed innocent people were being murdered. Would you have listened to his explanations, accepted the facts that his work was worth the cost of a few lives so that future billions of human beings might be saved? No, there was no time for explanation or indoctrination. Leffingwell chose concealment." "Yes," Harry sighed, "I understand that better now, I think, but I couldn't see it then when I tried to kill him." He flushed. "And I still can't quite comprehend why he spared me after that attempt."
"Because he wasn't the monster you thought him to be. When I pleaded with him..."
"You were the one?" Harry's son turned away.
"Yes. When I was told who you really were, I went to him. But I was only a child, remember that, and he didn't spare you out of sentimentality. He had a purpose.
A purpose in sending me to prison, letting me rot all these years while...
While I grew up, I and others like myself, and while the world outside changed.
Harry's son smiled. Your friend Richard Wade was right, you know. He guessed a great deal of the truth. Leffingwell and Manshoff and the rest of their associates deliberately set out to assemble a select group of nonconformists, men of specialized talents and outlooks. There were over 300 of you at Stark Falls. Richard Wade knew why.
And so he was dragged off and murdered?
Murdered? No, Father, he's very much alive, I assure you. In fact, he'll be here tonight.
But why was he taken away so abruptly, without any warning?
He was needed. There was a crisis when Dr. Leffingwell died.
Harry's son sighed.
You didn't know about that, did you? There's so much for you to learn. But I'll let him tell you himself when you see him this evening.
Richard Wade told him, and so did William Chang, and Lars Nielstrom, and all the others. During the ensuing weeks, Harry saw each of them again, but Wade's explanation was sufficient.
I was right, he said. There was no underground when we were at Stark Falls. What I didn't realize, though, was that there was an overground.
Overground?
You might call it that. Leffingwell and his staff formed the nucleus. They foresaw the social crisis which lay ahead. When the world became physically divided into the tall and the short, the young and the old, they knew there'd be a need of individuality then, and they did create a stockpile of the younger generation, specially educated, a stockpile of the older generation, carefully selected. We conspicuous rebels were incarcerated and given an opportunity to think the problem through, with limited contact with one another's viewpoints.
But why weren't we told the truth at the beginning, allowed to meet face to face and make some sensible plans for the future?
Harry's son interrupted.
Because Dr. Leffingwell realized this would defeat the ultimate purpose. You'd have formed your own in-group as prisoners, dedicated to your own welfare. There'd be emotional ties.
I still don't know what you're talking about. What are we supposed to prepare for now?
Richard Wade shrugged.
Leffingwell had it all planned. He foresaw that when the first generation of Yardsticks, that's what they call themselves, you know, came of age, there'd be social unrest. The young people would want to take over, and the older generation would try to remain in positions of power. It was his belief that tensions could be alleviated only by proper leadership on both sides. He himself had an important voice in government circles. He set up an arrangement whereby a certain number of posts would be assigned to people of his choice, both young and old. Similarly, in the various professions there'd be room for appointees he'd select. Given a year or two of training, Leffingwell felt that we'd be ready for these positions. Young men like your son would be placed in key spots where their influence would be helpful with the Yardsticks. Older men, such as yourself, would go into other assignments, in communications media chiefly. The skillful use of group psychological techniques could avert open clashes. He predicted a danger period lasting about 20 years, roughly from 2030 to 2050. Once we weathered that span, equilibrium would be regained, as a second and third generation came along and the elders became a small minority. If we did our work well and eliminated the sources of prejudice, friction, and hostility, the transition could be made. The overground in governmental circles would finance us. This was Leffingwell's plan, his dream.
You speak in the past tense, Harry said.
Yes, Wade's voice was harsh. Because Leffingwell is dead of cerebral hemorrhage, and his plan died with him. Oh, we still have some connections in government, enough to get men like yourself out of Stark Falls. But things have moved too swiftly. The Yardsticks are already on the march. The people in power, even those we relied upon, are getting frightened. They can't see that there's time left to train us to take over, and frankly I'm afraid most of them have no inclination to give up their present power. They intend to use force.
But you talk as though the Yardsticks were united.
They are uniting, and swiftly. Remember the Naturalists?
Harry nodded slowly.
I was one once, or I thought I was.
You were a liberal. I'm talking about the new Naturalists, the ones bent on actual revolution.
Revolution?
That's the word, and that's the situation. It's coming to a head fast.
And how will we prevent it?
I don't know.
Harry's son stared up at him. Most of us believe it's too late to prevent it. Our immediate problem will be survival. The naturalists want control for themselves. The yardsticks intend to destroy the power of the older generation, and we feel that if matters come to a head soon, the government itself may turn on us too. They'll have to.
In other words, Harry said, we stand alone.
Fall alone, more likely, Wade corrected.
How many of us are there?
About 600, said Harry's son, located in private homes throughout this eastern area. If there's violence, we don't have a chance of controlling the situation.
But we can survive, as I see it. That's our only salvation at the moment, to somehow survive the coming conflict. Then perhaps we can find a way to function as Leffingwell planned.
We'll never survive here. They'll use every conceivable weapon.
But since there's no open break with the government yet, we could still presumably arrange for transportation facilities.
To where?
Some spot in which we could weather the storm. What about Leffingwell's old hideout?
The units are still standing, Harry's son nodded.
Yes, that's a possibility, but what about food?
Grizzik.
What?
Friend of mine, Harry told him. Look, we're going to have to work fast, and yet we've got to do it in a way that won't attract any attention, not even from the government. I suggest we set up an organizing committee and make plans.
He frowned.
How much time do you think we have? A year or so?
6 months, his son hazarded.
4 at most, Wade said. Haven't you been getting the full reports on those riots? Pretty soon they'll declare a state of national emergency, and then nobody will be going anywhere.
All right, Harry Collins grinned. We'll do it in 4 months.
Actually, as it worked out, they did it in just a day or so under 3.
542 men moved by jetter to Colorado Springs, thence by helicopter to the Canyon Hideaway. They moved in small groups, a few each week. Harry himself had already established the liaison system, and he was based at Grizzik's ranch. Grizzik was dead, but Bassett and Tom Lowry remained, and they cooperated. Food would be ready for the copters that came out of the canyon. The canyon installation itself was deserted, and the only problem it presented was one of rehabilitation. The first contingent took over. The jetters carried more than their human cargo. They were filled with equipment of all sorts, microscans and laboratory instruments and devices for communication. By the time the entire group was assembled, they had the necessary implementation for study and research. It was a well-conceived and well-executed operation. To his surprise, Harry found himself acting as the leader of the expedition, and he continued in this capacity after they were established. The irony of the situation did not escape him. To all intents and purposes, he was now ruling the very domain in which he had once languished as a prisoner. But with Wade and Chang and the others, he set up a provisional system which worked out very well, and proved very helpful once the news reached them that open revolt had begun in the world outside. A battered copter landed one evening at dusk, and the wounded pilot poured out his message, then his life's blood. Angelisco was gone. Washington was gone. The naturalists had struck using the old outlawed weapons, and it was the same abroad according to the few garbled reports thereafter obtainable only via ancient shortwave devices. From then on, nobody left the canyon except on weekly copter lifts to the ranch grazing lands for fresh supplies. Fortunately, that area was undisturbed, and so were its laconic occupants. They neither knew nor cared what went on in the world outside, what cities were reported destroyed, what forces triumphed or went down into defeat, what activity or radioactivity prevailed. Life in the canyon flowed on, more peacefully than the river cleaving its center. There was much to do and much to learn. It was actually a monastic existence, compounded of frugality, abstinence, continence, and devotion to scholarly pursuits. Within a year, gardens flourished. Within 2 years, herds grazed the grassy slopes. Within 3 years, cloth was being woven on looms in the ancient way, and most of the homespun arts of an agrarian society had been revived. Men fell sick and men died, but the survivors lived in amity. Harry Collins celebrated his 60th birthday as the equivalent of a second-year student of medicine, his instructor being his own son. Everyone was studying some subject, acquiring some new skill. One-time rebellious natures and one-time biological oddities alike were united by the common bond of intellectual curiosity. It was, however, no utopia. Some of the younger men wanted women, and there were no women. Some were irked by confinement and wandered off. 3 of the fleet of 11 copters were stolen by groups of malcontents.
From time to time there would be a serious quarrel. 6 men were murdered. The population dwindled to 420. But there was progress in the main. Eventually Banning joined the group from the ranch, and under his guidance the study system was formalized. Attempts were made to project the future situation, to prepare for the day when it would be possible to venture safely into the outside world once again and utilize newly won abilities. Nobody could predict when that would be, nor what kind of world would await their coming. By the time the 5th year had passed, even short-wave reports had long since ceased. Rumors persisted that radioactive contamination was widespread, that the population had been virtually decimated, that the government had fallen, that the naturalists had set up their own reign only to fall victim to internal strife. But one thing is certain, Harry Collins told his companions as they assembled in the usual monthly meeting on the grounds before the old headquarters building one afternoon in July. The fighting will end soon. If we hear nothing more within the next few months, we'll send out observation parties. Once we determine the exact situation, we can plan accordingly. The world is going to need what we can give. It will use what we have learned. It will accept our aid. One of these days, and he went on to outline a carefully calculated program of making contact with the powers that be, or might be. It sounded logical, and even the chronic grumblers and habitual pessimists in the group were encouraged. If at times they felt the situation fantastic and the hope forlorn, they were heartened now. Richard Wade summed it up succinctly afterwards in a private conversation with Harry. "It isn't going to be easy," he said. "In the old science fiction yarns I used to write, a group like this would have been able to prevent the revolution. At the very least it would decide who won if fighting actually broke out. But in reality, we were too late to forestall revolt, and we couldn't win the war no matter on whose side we fought. There's just one job we're equipped for, and that's to win the peace. I don't mean we'll step out of here and take over the world, either. We'll have to move slowly and cautiously, dispersing in little groups of 5 or 6 all over the country. And we'll have to sound out men in the communities we go to, find those who are willing to learn and willing to build. But we can be an influence, and an important one. We have the knowledge and the skill. We may not be chosen to lead, but we can teach the leaders, and that's important." Harry smiled in agreement. They did have something to offer, and surely it would be recognized, even if the naturalists had won, even if the entire country had sunk into semi-barbarism. No use anticipating such problems now. Wait until fall came. Then they'd reconnoiter and find out. Wait until fall. It was a wise decision, but one which ignored a single important fact. The naturalists didn't wait until fall to conduct their reconnaissance. They came over the canyon that very night, a large group of them in a large jetter, and they dropped a large bomb. End of Chapter 10 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 11 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Reading by Greg Marguerite. This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 11. Jesse Pringle, 2039. They were after him. The whole world was in flames, and the buildings were falling. The mighty were fallen. The day of judgment was at hand. He ran through the flames blindly. Blind Samson, Eyeless and Gaza, treading at the mill. The mills of the gods grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small. Small, they were all small, but that didn't matter. They had the guns, and they were hunting him down to his doom. Day of doom, doomsday. The great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns was abroad in the land. They had unleashed the dragon, and his breath was a fire that seared, and his tail was a thunder that toppled towers. The dragon was searching him out for his sins. He would be captured and set to labor in the mill. But he would escape. He must escape. He was afraid of them, small as they were, and great oaks from little acorns grow. It's the little things that count, and he dare not go a-hunting for fear of little men. Jesse crouched against the dock, watching the grain elevators burn. The whole city was burning. Babylon the Mighty. The whole world was burning in God's final wrath of judgment. Nobody believed in God anymore. Nobody read the Bible, and that's why they didn't know these things. Jesse knew. because he was an old man, and he remembered how it had been when he was a little boy who learned of the word of God and the wrath of God. He could see the reflection of the flames in the water now, and the reflection was shimmery and broken because of the black clusters floating past. Large clusters and small clusters. There were bodies in the water. The bodies of the slain. Thunder boomed from the city behind him. Explosions. That's how it had started, when the naturalists began blowing up the buildings, and then the yardsticks had come with their weapons, hunting down the naturalists. Or had it been that way, really? It didn't matter now. That was in another country, and besides, the wench was dead. The wench is dead. His wench. Jesse's wench. She wasn't so old, only 72. But they killed her. They blew off the top of her head, and he could feel it when they did. It was as if something had happened in his head. And then he ran at them and screamed, and there was a great slaughter amongst the heathen, the forces of unrighteousness. And Jesse had fled and smote evil in the name of the Lord, for he perceived now that the time was at hand. How the mighty are fallen! Jesse blinked at the water, wishing it would clear, wishing his thoughts would clear. Sometimes, for a moment, he could remember back to the way things really were, when it was still a real world with real people in it, when he was just a little boy and everybody else was big. Strange. Now he was an old man, a big old man, and almost everybody else was little. He tried to think what it had been like so long ago. It was too long, and all he could remember about being small was that he had been afraid, afraid of the bigger people. And now he was big. And afraid of the smaller people. Of course they weren't real. It was just part of the prophecy. They were the locusts sent to consume and destroy. He kept telling himself there was nothing to fear. The righteous need not fear when the day of judgment is at hand. Only somewhere inside him was this little boy crying, "Mama, Mama, Mama." And somewhere else was this old man just staring down into the water and waiting for them to find him. Another explosion sounded. This one was closer. They must be bombing the entire city, or else it was the dragon lashing his tail. Somebody ran past Jesse carrying a torch. No, it wasn't a torch. His hair was on fire. He jumped into the water, screaming, "They're coming! They're coming!" Jesse turned and blinked. They were coming, all right. He could see them pouring out of the alleyways like rats, rats with gleaming eyes, gleaming claws. Suddenly his head cleared. He realized that he was going to die. He had perhaps 1 minute of life left. 1 minute out of 80 years, and he couldn't fool himself any longer. He was not delirious. Day of judgment? That was nonsense. And there was no dragon, and these were not rats. They were merely men, puny little men, who killed because they were afraid. Jesse was a big man, but he was afraid, too. 6 feet 3 inches tall he was when he stood up straight, as he did now, watching them come, but he knew fear. And he resolved that he must not take that fear with him into death. He wanted to die with something better than that. Wasn't there something he could find and cling to, perhaps some memory? A minute is so short, and 80 years is so long. Jesse stood there swaying, watching them draw nearer, watching them as they caught sight of him and raised their weapons. He scanned rapidly into the past before the time the wench was dead, back to when you and I were young, Maggie, back still earlier and earlier, seeking the high point, the high school. That was it, the high school, the highlight, the moment of triumph, the game with Lincoln. Yes, that was it. He hadn't been ashamed of being 6 feet 3 inches then. He'd been proud of it, proud as he raised his arms and splashed down into the water as the bullet struck. And that was the end of Jesse Pringle. Jesse Pringle, champion basketball center of the class of 79. End of Chapter 11 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 12 of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Reading by Greg Marguerite. This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch. Chapter 12, Little John, 2065. The helicopter landed on the roof, and the attendants wheeled it over to one side. They propped the ladder up, and Little John descended slowly, panting. They had a coaster chair waiting, and he sank into it, grateful for the rest. Hardy fellows, these attendants, but then they were almost 3 feet tall. More stamina, that was the secret. Common stock, of course, but they served a purpose. Somebody had to carry out the orders. When they wheeled the coaster chair into the elevator, Littlejohn descended. The elevator halted on the first floor, and he breathed a sigh of relief. Great heights always made him faint and dizzy, and even a short helicopter trip took its toll. The mere thought of soaring 200 feet above the ground was enough to paralyze him. But this journey was vital. Thurman was waiting for him. Yes, Thurman was waiting for him here in the council chamber. The coaster chair rolled forward into the room, and again Littlejohn felt a twinge of apprehension. The room was vast, too big for comfort. It must be all of 50 feet long and over 10 feet in height. How could Thurman stand it, working here? But he had to endure it. Littlejohn reminded himself he was head of the council. Thurman was lying on the couch when Littlejohn rolled in, but he sat up and smiled. "I greet you," he said. "I greet you," Littlejohn answered. "No, don't bother to stay seated. Surely we don't need to be ceremonious." Thurman pricked up his ears at the sound of the unfamiliar word. He wasn't the scholarly type like Littlejohn, but he appreciated Littlejohn's learning and knew he was important to the council. They needed scholars these days, and antiquarians, too. One has to look to the past when rebuilding a world. "You sent for me?" Littlejohn asked. The question was purely rhetorical, but he wanted to break the silence. Thurman looked troubled as he replied. "Yes, it's a matter of confidence between us." "So be it. You may speak in trust." Thurman eyed the door. "Come nearer," he said. Littlejohn pressed a lever and rolled up to the couch side. Thurman's eyes peered at him through the thick contact lenses. Littlejohn noted the deep wrinkles around his mouth, but without surprise. After all, Thurman was an old man. He must be over 30. "I've been thinking," Thurman said abruptly. "We have failed."
"Failed?"
Thurman nodded. "Need I explain? You have been close to the council for many years. You have seen what we've attempted ever since the close of the Naturalist Wars." "A magnificent effort," Littlejohn answered politely. "In less than 30 years an entire new world has risen from the ruins of the old. Civilization has been restored, snatched from the very brink of a barbarism that threatened to engulf us."
"Nonsense," Thurman muttered.
"What?"
"Sheer nonsense, Littlejohn. You're talking like a pedant."
"But I am a pedant," Littlejohn nodded, "and it's true. When the Naturalists were exterminated, this nation and other nations were literally destroyed. Worse than physical destruction was the threat of mental and moral collapse. But the Yardstick Councils arose to take over. The concept of small government came into being and saved us. We began to rebuild on a sensible scale with local limited control. The little community arose."
"Spare me the history lesson," said Thurman dryly. "We rebuilt, yes, we survived. In a sense, perhaps, we even made certain advances. There is no longer any economic rivalry, no social distinctions, no external pressures. I think I can safely assume that the danger of future warfare is forever banished. The balance of power is no longer a factor. The balance of nature has been partially restored. And only one problem remains to plague mankind."
"What is that?"
"We face extinction," Thurman said.
"But that's not true," Littlejohn interrupted. "Look at history and..."
"Look at us," Thurman sighed. "You needn't bother with history. The answer is written in our faces, in our bodies. I've searched the past very little compared to your scholarship, but enough to know that things were different in the old days. The Naturalists, whatever else they might have been, were strong men. They walked freely in the land. They lived lustily and long. Do you know what our average life expectancy is today, Littlejohn? A shade under 40 years. And that only if one is fortunate enough to lead a sheltered existence as we do. In the mines, in the fields, in the radioactive areas, they die before the age of 30. Littlejohn leaned forward.
"Schuller touches on just that point in his Psychology of Time," he said eagerly. "He posits the relationship between size and duration. Time is relative, you know. Our lives, short as they may be in terms of comparative chronology, nevertheless have a subjective span equal to that of the Naturalists in their heyday."
"Nonsense," Thurman said again. "Did you think that's what concerns me? Whether or not we feel that our lives are long or short?"
"What then?"
"I'm talking about the basic elements essential to survival. I'm talking about strength, stamina, endurance, the ability to function. That's what we're losing, along with the normal span of years. The world is soft and flabby. Yardstick children tell us they were healthy at first, but their children are weaker, and their grandchildren weaker still. The effect of the wars, the ravages of radiation and malnutrition have taken a terrible toll. The world is soft and flabby today. People can't walk anymore, let alone run. We find it difficult to lift and bend and work." "But we won't have to worry about such matters for long," Littlejohn hazarded. "Think of what's been done in robotics. Those recent experiments seem to prove..."
"I know," Thurman nodded. "We can create robots, no doubt. We have a limited amount of raw materials to allocate to the project, and if we can perfect automatons, they'll function quite adequately. Virtually indestructible, too, I understand. I imagine they'll still be able to operate efficiently 100 or more years from now if only they learn to oil and repair one another, because by that time, the human race will be gone."
"Come now, it isn't that serious."
"Oh, but it is." Thurman raised himself again with an effort. "Your study of history should have taught you one thing, if nothing else. The tempo is quickening. While it took mankind thousands of years to move from the bow and arrow to the rifle, it took only a few hundred to move from the rifle to the thermonuclear weapon. It took ages before men mastered flight, and then in 2 generations they developed satellites. In 3, they reached the moon and Mars."
"But we're talking about physical development."
"I know. And physically, the human race altered just as drastically in an equally short span of time. As recently as the 19th century, the incidence of disease was 1,000-fold greater than it is now. Life was short then. In the 20th century, disease lessened and life expectancy doubled in certain areas. Height and weight increased perceptibly with every passing decade. Then came Leffingwell and his injections. Height, weight, life expectancy have fallen perceptibly every decade since then. The war merely hastened the process."
"You appear to have devoted a great deal of time to this question," Littlejohn observed.
"I have," answered the older man. "And it's not a question. It's a fact. The one fact that confronts us all. If we proceed along our present path, we face certain extinction in a very short time. The strain is weakening constantly. The vitality is draining away. We sought to defeat nature, but the naturalists were right in their way."
"And the solution?"
Thurman was silent for a long moment. Then, "I have none," he said.
"You have consulted the medical authorities?"
"Naturally. And experiments have been made. Physical conditioning systems of exercise, experimentation in chemotherapy are still being undertaken. There's no lack of volunteers, but a great lack of results."
"No, the answer does not lie in that direction."
"But what else is there?"
"That is what I had hoped you might tell me," Thurman said. "You are a scholar. You know the past. You speak often of the lessons of history."
Littlejohn was nodding, but not in agreement. He was trying to comprehend, for suddenly the conviction came to him clearly. Thurman was right. It was happening, and happened right under their smug noses. The world was weakening. It was slowing down, and the race is only to the swift. He cursed himself for his habit of thinking in platitudes and quotations, but long years of study had unfitted him for less prosaic phraseology. If he could only be practical.
Practical.
"Thurman," he said, "there is a way. A way so obvious we've all overlooked it, passed right over it."
"And that is?"
"Stop the Leffingwell injections."
"But..."
"I know what you'll say. There have been genetic mutations, very true, but such mutations can't be universal. A certain percentage of offspring will be sound, capable of attaining full growth. And we don't have the population problem to cope with anymore. There's room for people again. So why not try it? Stop the injections and allow babies to be born as they were before."
Littlejohn hesitated before adding a final word, but he knew he had to add it. He knew it now.
"Normally," he said.
Thurman nodded.
"So that is your answer?"
"Yes, I think it will work."
"So do the biologists," Thurman told him. "A generation of normal infants reared to maturity would restore mankind to its former stature in every sense of the word. And now, knowing the lessons of the past, we could prepare for the change to come. We could rebuild the world for them to live in, rebuild it psychically as well as physically. We'd plan to eliminate the rivalry between the large and the small, the strong and the weak. It wouldn't be difficult, because there's plenty for all. There'd be no trouble as there was in the old days. We've learned to be psychologically flexible."
Littlejohn smiled.
"Then that is the solution?" he asked.
"Yes. Eliminating the Leffingwell injections will give us a good proportion of normal children again. But where do we find the normal women to bear them?"
"Normal women?"
Thurman sighed.
then reached over and placed a scroll in the scanner. "I have already gone into that question with research technicians," he said, "and I have the figures here." He switched on the scanner and began to read. "The average nubile female, aged 13 to 21, is 2 feet 10 inches high and weighs 48 pounds. Thurman flicked the switch again and peered up. "I don't think I'll bother with pelvic measurements," he said. "You can already see that giving birth to a 6 or 7 pound infant is physically impossible under the circumstances. It cannot be done." "But surely there must be some larger females, perhaps a system of selective breeding on a gradual basis." "You're talking in terms of generations. We haven't got that much time." Thurman shook his head. "No, we're stopped right here. We can't get normal babies without normal women, and the only normal women are those who began life as normal babies."
"Which comes first?" Little John murmured. "The chicken or the egg?"
"What's that?"
"Nothing. Just an old saying from history."
Thurman frowned. "Apparently, then, that's all you can offer in your professional capacity as a historian, just some old sayings." He sighed. "Too bad you don't know some old prayers, because we need them now."
He bowed his head, signifying the end of the interview. Little John rolled out of the room. His copter took him back to his own dwelling back across the rooftops of New Chicago. Ordinarily, Little John avoided looking down. He dreaded heights, and the immensity of the city itself was somehow appalling. But now he gazed upon the capital and center of civilization with a certain morbid affection. New Chicago had risen on the ashes of the old after the war's end. Use of thermonukes had been limited, fortunately, so radioactivity did not linger, and the vast craters hollowed out by ordinary warheads had been partially filled in by rubble and debris. Artificial fill had done the rest of the job, so that now New Chicago was merely a flat prairie, as it must have been hundreds of years ago, a flat prairie on which the city had been resurrected. There were almost 50,000 people here in the capital, the largest congregation of population on the entire continent. They had built well and surely this time, built for the security and certainty of centuries to come. Little John sighed. It was hard to accept the fact that they had been wrong, that all this would end in nothingness. They had eliminated war, eliminated disease, eliminated famine, eliminated social inequality, injustice, disorders external and internal, and in so doing, they had eliminated themselves. The sun was setting in the west, and long shadows crept over the city below. Yes, the sun was setting and the shadows were gathering. The night was coming to claim its own. Darkness was falling. Eternal darkness. It was quite dark by the time Little John's copter landed on the rooftop of his own dwelling. So dark, in fact, that for a moment he didn't see the strange vehicle already standing there. Not until he had settled into his coaster chair did he notice the presence of the other copter, and then it was too late. Too late to do anything except sit and stare as the gigantic shadow loomed out of the night, silhouetted against the sky. The shadow shambled forward, and Little John gaped in terror at the titanic figure. He opened his mouth to speak, but words did not form. There were no words to form, for how does one address an apparition? Instead, it was the apparition which spoke.
"I have been waiting for you," it said.
Yes?
"I want to talk to you." The voice was deep, menacing.
Little John shifted in his coaster chair. There was nowhere to go, no escape. He gazed up at the shadow. Finally, he summoned a response.
"Shall we go inside?" he asked.
The figure shook its head.
"Where? Down into that dollhouse of yours? It isn't big enough. I've already been there. What I have to say can be said right here."
Who are you?"
The figure stepped forward so that its face was illuminated by the fluorescence streaming in the open door which led to the inclined chairway descending to Little John's dwelling. Little John could see the face now, the gigantic, wrinkled face, scarred and seared and seamed. It was a human face, but utterly alien to the humanity Little John knew. Faces such as this one had disappeared from the earth a lifetime ago. At least, history had taught him that. History had not prepared him for the actual living presence of a...
"Naturalist," Little John gasped. "You're a naturalist. Yes, that's what you are."
The apparition scowled. "I am not a naturalist. I am a man."
"But you can't be. The war."
"I am very old. I lived through your war. I have lived through your peace. Soon I shall die. But before I do, there is something else which must be done."
"You've come here to kill me?"
"Perhaps. The looming figure moved closer and stared down. "No, don't try to summon help. When your servants saw me, they fled. You're alone now, Little John."
"You know my name?"
"Yes, I know your name. I know the names of everyone on the council. Each of them has a visitor tonight."
"Then it's a plot, a conspiracy?"
"We have planned this very carefully through the long years. It's all we lived for, those few of us who survived the war."
"But the council wasn't responsible for the war. Most of us weren't even alive then. Believe me, we weren't to blame."
"I know." The gigantic face creased in a senile simulation of a smile. "Nobody was ever to blame for anything. Nobody was ever responsible. That's what they always told me. I mustn't hate mankind for multiplying, even though population created pressure, and pressure created panic, and that drove me mad. I mustn't blame Leffingwell for solving the overpopulation problem, even though he used me as a guinea pig in his experiments. I mustn't blame the Yardsticks for penning me up in a prison until revolution broke out. And I mustn't blame the Naturalists for bombing the place where I took refuge. So whose fault was it that I've gone through 80 years of a sordid hell? Why did I, Harry Collins, get singled out for a lifetime of misery and misfortune?" The huge old man bent over Little John's huddled form. "Maybe it was all a means to an end, a way of bringing me here, at this moment, to do what must be done."
Don't harm me. You're not well. You're..."
"Crazy?" The old man shook his head. "No, I'm not crazy. Not now. But I have been at times during my life. Perhaps we all are when we attempt to face up to the complications of an average existence. Try to confront the problems which are too big for a single consciousness to cope with in a single lifespan. I've been crazy in the city, and crazy in the isolation of a cell, and crazy in the welter of war. And perhaps the worst time of all was when I lost my son."
"Yes, I had a son, Little John. He was one of the first, one of Leffingwell's original mutations, and I never knew him very well until the revolution came and we went away together. He was a doctor, my boy, and a good one. We spent almost 5 years together, and I learned a lot from him, about medicine, but that wasn't important then. I'm thinking of what I learned about love. I'd always hated Yardsticks, but my son was one, and I came to love him. He had plans for rebuilding the world, he and I and the rest of us. We were going to wait until the revolution ended and then help restore sanity and civilization. But the Naturalists flew over and dropped their bomb, and my boy died. Over 400 of our group died there in the canyon, 400 who might have changed the fate of the world. Do you think I can forget that? Do you think I and the few others who survived have ever forgotten? Can you blame us if we did go crazy, if we hid away out there in the western wilderness, hid away from a world that had offered us nothing but death and destruction, and plotted to bring death and destruction to that world in return? Think about it for a moment, Little John. We were old men, all of us, and the world had given us only its misery to bear during our lifetimes. The world we wanted to save was destroying itself. Why should we be concerned with its fate or future? So we changed our plans, Little John. Perhaps the shock had been too much. Instead of plotting to rebuild the world, we turned our thoughts to completing its destruction. Our tools and texts were gone, buried in the rubble with the bodies of fine young men. But we had our minds, crazed minds, you'd call them, but aware of reality, the grim reality of the post-revolutionary years. We burrowed away in the desert. We schemed and we dreamed. From time to time we sent out spies. We knew what was going on. We knew the Naturalists were gone, that six-footers had vanished from a Yardstick world. We knew about the rehabilitation projects. We watched your people gradually evolve new patterns of living and learning. Some of the former knowledge was rescued, but not all. Our little group had far more learning than you've ever dreamt of. 50 of us between ourselves could have surpassed all your scientists in every field. But we watched and we waited. And some of us died of privation, and some of us died of old age, until at last there were only a dozen of us to share the dream of destruction. And we knew that we must act swiftly, or not at all. So we came into the world, cautiously and carefully, moving unobtrusively and unobserved. We wanted to contemplate the corruption, seek out the weaknesses in your degenerate civilization, and we found them, immediately. Those weaknesses are everywhere apparent, for they are physical. You're one of a dying race, Little John. Mankind's days are numbered. There's no need for grandiose schemes of reactivating warheads in buried missile centers, of loosing thermonukes upon the world.
Merely by killing off the Central Council here in New Chicago, we can accomplish our objective. A dozen men die, and there's not enough initiative left to replace them. It's as simple as that, and as complicated." Harry Collins nodded. "Yes, as complicated, because the only weaknesses we've observed are physical ones. We've seen enough of the ways of this new civilization to realize that. All of the things I hated during my lifetime have disappeared now. The crowding, the competition, the sordid self-interest, the bigotry, intolerance, prejudice, the antisocial aspects of society are gone. There is only the human race, living much closer to the concept of utopia than I ever dreamed possible. You and the other survivors have done well, Littlejohn."
"And yet you come to kill us?"
"We came for that purpose because we still retained the flaws and failings of our former cultures. We looked for targets to blame, for villains to hate and destroy. Instead, we found this reality."
"No, I'm not crazy, Littlejohn, and I and my fellows aren't here to execute revenge. We have returned to the original plan, the plan Leffingwell had, and my son, and all the others who worked in their own way for the dream of a better world. We come now to help you before you die, before we die."
Littlejohn looked up and sighed. "Why couldn't this have happened before?" he murmured. "It's too late now."
"But it isn't too late. My friends are here. They are telling your fellow council members the same thing right now. We may be old, but we can still impart what we have learned. There are any number of technological developments to be made. We can help you to increase your use of atomic power. There's soil reclamation and irrigation projects and biological techniques."
"You said it yourself," Littlejohn whispered. "We're a dying race. That's the primary problem, and it's an insoluble one. Just this afternoon," and he told him about the interview with Thurman.
"Don't you understand," Littlejohn concluded, "we have no solution for survival. We're paying the price now because for a while we wouldn't heed history. We tried to defeat nature, and in the end, nature has defeated us. Because we would not render unto Caesar the things which are..."
Harry Collins smiled.
"That's it," he said.
"What?"
"Caesar. That's the answer. Your own medical men must have records. I know, because I learned medicine from my son. There used to be an operation, in the old days, called a caesarean section, used on normal women and on dwarfs and midgets, too, in childbirth. If your problem is how to deliver normal children safely, the technique can be revived. Get hold of some of your people. Let's see what data they have on this. I'll be glad to furnish instruction."
There was excitement after that. Too much excitement for Littlejohn. By the time the council had assembled an emergency session, by the time plans were formulated and he returned to his own dwelling in the helicopter, he was completely exhausted. Only the edge of elation sustained him, the realization that a solution had been found. As he sank into slumber, he knew that he would sleep the clock around. And so would Harry Collins. The old man and his companions, now guests of the council, had been temporarily quartered in the council chambers. It was the only structure large enough to house them, and even so they had to sleep on the floor. But it was sufficient comfort for the moment. It was many hours before Harry Collins awoke. His waking was automatic, for the tiny telescreen at the end of the council room glowed suddenly, and the traditional voice chirped forth to interrupt his slumber.
"Good morning," said the voice. "It's a beautiful day in New Chicago."
Harry stared at the screen, and then he smiled. "Yes," he murmured, "but tomorrow will be better."
End of This Crowded Earth by Robert Bloch.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.